This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Russian president changes his stance on Ukraine's presidential election. A U.S. military team heading to Nigeria to help search for kidnapped schoolgirls. Analyzing the terrorism issue in China. A look at the defense building in Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
There's nothing more important and critical for any country in any region to have domestic military capabilities.
And we hear from a Harlem jazz singer and Afro-pop diva with something more. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian President Vladimir Putin Wednesday at the Kremlin suggested publicly for the first time that Ukraine's May 25th presidential election, the target of recent Kremlin scorn, is now a move in the right direction. However, Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk dismissed Mr. Putin's comments as hot air. Mr. Putin also said Russian military units massed on the Ukraine border have pulled back from their forward positions. However, the White House, the Pentagon, and NATO all said no immediate signs of a withdrawal have been detected. NATO and the Pentagon have identified at least 40,000 Russian troops and armor poised on the border in recent weeks. The troops' presence has drawn widespread criticism from Kiev and from Western governments, which see the deployment as a move to intimidate Ukraine that has heightened tensions across much of the country. For a look at the Ukrainian military power, we hear from VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnara.
Western estimates say the Ukrainian Defense Ministry controls between 70,000 to 130,000 men under arms. But Stephen Blank, an expert at the American Foreign Policy Council, says Ukraine's armed forces have enormous problems.
Their command and control at the top has been very shaky. There have been several defense ministers and heads of various forces since the new government came to power. Second, their intelligence services have been penetrated for a long time by Russians. Third, they have been undercapitalized, victimized by corruption and poor leadership for years.
Kerr Giles, head of the Conflict Studies Research Center, says Ukraine has been trying to modernize its armed forces.
It is a great deal less ambitious and less well-funded than the equivalent in Russia. So Ukraine is still operating the kinds of equipment which are no longer in service with the spearhead of the Russian forces. These are older types. They have an older manning system. Much less has changed for the Ukrainian military since the end of the Soviet Union than it has for Russia since the Georgia War.
Experts say Russia's effort to modernize its military was prompted by the poor showing in Moscow's 2008 five-day war with Georgia over two separatist regions. One reform was to make the Russian military more mobile, better geared for rapid response and for local conflicts. The result of those reforms were on display during Russia's annexation last month of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Experts say Ukraine is still tied to having a large Soviet-style army. Giles says another problem facing the Ukrainian military is the potential divided loyalty of its members.
Now, we shouldn't believe all of the stories that we've seen coming out of eastern Ukraine about defections, but it's still the case that many of the senior levels of the Ukrainian armed forces served together with their Russian counterparts in the Soviet armed forces. And it's still the case that many of the Ukrainian servicemen that we have encountered in the days before this crisis emerged described themselves quite openly as being Russian.
Pro-Russian separatists control about a dozen towns and cities in eastern Ukraine. In addition, an estimated 40,000 Russian troops have been deployed on the Ukrainian border, the spearhead of a potential invasion force. Kerr Giles and others say the Ukrainian military is not ready to thwart a Russian invasion if it happens.
Certainly in terms of capability, the Russian armed forces are far better equipped and better organized at present than the Ukrainian equivalents. However, there are caveats to that. Now, many of the people who look at the sustainability and logistics of the Russian armed forces still believe that they are no longer in a position to fight an extended campaign, which is, of course, a risk if they overextend themselves into Ukraine. So any operation in Ukraine would have to be as quick or as unopposed as the armed conflict in Georgia or the operation in Crimea.
Experts say if Russia invades eastern Ukraine, it runs the risk of a protracted war, especially if the Ukrainians engaged in guerrilla warfare. And that, say analysts, is not a scenario favored by Moscow. Andrei Dineshnara, VOA News, Washington.
Bital Sahab, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, has released his substantial report on military activities in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. in the Gulf Rising Defense Industrialization in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. He finds the two nations have been steadily improving their capabilities. We asked him, what exactly does defense industrialization mean?
Well, basically, it's the effort to create what you call a local defense industry. And that essentially means any effort to produce and manufacture arms locally.
And what has Saudi Arabia and the UAE been doing about this?
Well, over the past decade, they have been quietly but steadily developing their defense industrial capabilities. And that essentially means that they have been able to manufacture, design, co-produce with international companies a bunch of military items, and that would include military vehicles, communication systems, unmanned systems, including aerial drones. They're now capable of maintaining a lot of those items. In the past, there was the old saying that Arabs simply cannot do maintenance. Basically, they would buy all sorts of weapon systems from the West and the United States, the most modern stuff, but they simply wouldn't be able to not only use them, but also maintain them. I think that over the past decade, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and those are the two countries I focus on, have upgraded significantly their capabilities in terms of maintenance, overhaul, repair, and like I said before, manufacturing.
What is their motive for doing this?
It's a great question. We don't typically know these things. They keep their cards close to their chest, but we can make several reasonable assumptions. And I list a few in my report. I think the most important one, I would say the most dominant one, would be national security. Sure, they have a great relationship with the United States, and then there's a strategic partnership between the United States and these two countries. But at the end of the day, there's nothing more important and critical for any country in any region to have domestic military capabilities, and that means that they have to rely on themselves to protect themselves and their own interests. So national security is a very dominant reason. Others I list there would include reducing their dependence, political dependence, on the United States and those outside powers that totally dominate the international defense market. So they're trying to achieve some sort of self-sufficiency in certain areas. They'll probably never get there anytime soon. A lot of countries around the world, even the most industrialized ones, will not achieve self-sufficiency, but their goal is always to reduce that dependency as much as possible.
Batal Sahab, resident senior fellow for Middle East security at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. He says another reason for the military buildup is prestige. We hope to bring you his comments on that tomorrow on our program. Hundreds of people are feared dead after militants attacked a town in northeastern Nigeria, setting fire to homes and businesses and shooting residents as they tried to escape. Local officials say suspected Boko Haram militants stormed the remote town of Gamboro Ngala on the border with Cameroon. News reports say more than 250 homes, the town's biggest market, and a police station were destroyed. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is providing details about a team of experts heading to Nigeria to help with the search for 276 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the team will arrive in a few days.
Their mission there is to simply assess and advise. These personnel will be experts in areas to include communications, logistics, intelligence, all of the functionalities that we believe will be helpful.
Colonel Warren says the United States is not considering a military operation to rescue the girls. Nigeria said Wednesday Britain also has agreed to assist with the search. It said President Goodluck Jonathan asked for and received a commitment for Britain to use its satellite capability and other advanced tracking technologies. One terrorism expert says despite horrific acts of brutality carried out by the Islamist group Boko Haram in Nigeria, the biggest international terrorist threat continues to emanate from the Middle East, specifically Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Greg Barton, acting director of the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the issue. He notes there is the Jabhat al-Nusra, which operates with rebel forces in Syria, the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria, which reportedly controls the city of Fallujah in Iraq, and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, based in Yemen. As for Boko Haram, which has attacked schools, churches, mosques, police stations, and markets while seeking to establish strict Islamic law in Muslim-majority northern Nigeria, Barton says most attacks are confined to Nigeria. He says the government has shown it is incapable of dealing with the threat and, in fact, bears some of the blame for the group's violent turn in 2009.
This is a group that only came into formation about a dozen years ago. It only turned violent and self-consciously became jihadi in 2009, just 5 years ago. And in part, that was because of response to police brutality. There was an incident in which as many as 700 Boko Haram members died in police custody. Now, the group itself has behaved in a most barbarous fashion, and nothing we say about it can excuse its behavior. But we need to look at what drives a group like this in surviving in a society that doesn't like it. Boko Haram is very unpopular in Nigeria. It doesn't reflect traditional Nigerian understandings of Islam. No one wants them around. Their behavior is completely horrible. So how could they possibly recruit and grow? And so far, it's been partly because of inept police and military responses and often heavy-handed, overly brutal responses that leave family members responding to the death of a loved one by signing up with the group. So we should be very careful about isolating these groups in society and diminishing the power to reproduce themselves and slowly try and bring them under control in terms of their recruiting. And to do that, it's the hearts and minds piece. We need to get general society on board and protect those who are vulnerable to reprisals and protect those who are vulnerable to being preyed upon for recruiting.
You've noticed now the international response. Do you expect this to become an international fight in Nigeria?
I think the U.S. is torn between two impulses here. And one, there's a very natural impulse, to desire to try and help. I mean, schoolgirls being taken hostage, possibly to be sold off as slaves or into marriage. You can't think of a more horrible image that should rightly evoke a response. So the U.S. And other nations naturally want to try and do something. U.S. special forces could do something very useful on the ground. On the other hand, there's no desire for this to be a U.S. military operation. So more in the realm of giving technical assistance, helping the Nigerian military police locate Boko Haram groups and locate their hostages, and then helping them move in a way that minimizes loss of life. The potential for this to end up like the siege of Waco is very high. And of course, Waco occurred in America, so even in the world's most advanced military power, authorities can make mistakes and make matters worse. So I think it's right that America should be involved and other nations, and I think we'll see increasing attention on Boko Haram. But we need to look at the structural issues that made it possible for this group to emerge and work with the Nigerian state to try and diminish those weaknesses in the state. And it's not simply a case of poverty, it's not simply a case of inequity, but the fact that the northeast of Nigeria has proven fairly fertile for this group to operate means that more needs to be done on local security and on addressing local grievances and providing other ways of getting young people into meaningful employment so that they're not at a loose end and prey to being recruited by such groups.
Greg Barton, Acting Director of the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University. China's first report on national security was issued this week and warns that terrorist incidents are on the rise, with the government and police as the main targets. The Blue Book says the infiltration of religious extremists poses a threat to the solidarity of socialist belief. Domestically, the report cited 10 violent terrorist attacks that occurred within China in 2013. It says this threat prompted Beijing to create a National Security Council to coordinate its response. Tuesday, Chinese state media said 6 people were wounded in a knife attack at a train station in the southern city of Guangzhou. On April 30th, one person was killed and nearly 80 wounded in a bomb and knife attack at a train station in the western city of Urumqi. While in March, attackers using machetes killed 29 people and wounded more than 140 at a railway station in the southwest city at Kunming. Officials have blamed terrorists for the restive region of Xinjiang. But James Leibold, an ethnic minorities expert with Australia's La Trobe University based in Beijing, tells VOA's Victor Beattie, caution must be used before ascribing such attacks to religions, including Muslim extremists from Xinjiang.
And what we do know is that there have been a spate of mainly knife, some explosive attacks outside mainly train stations in China, but we also had that suicide car bombing in Tiananmen. So if you go back to October of last year, you've had a total of 4 incidences. The car bombing in Tiananmen, the March attack at the Kunming train station, last week explosive and knife attack outside the Urumqi train station, and then this most recent attack in Guangzhou. I think it's very premature to link these together. We have no direct evidence that they are linked in any way. They could be a case of sort of copycat attacks that are, you know, inspired by sort of media reports of each other. They could be quite separate events. You know, this most recent one in Guangzhou could be a case of a lone wolf that might be completely unconnected to the other ones. I mean, we just don't know. The authorities have not identified the individual. They say there was one perpetrator in Guangzhou. They have not released his identity or his ethnicity or any details on him and what may have motivated him to lead that attack. I mean, there are other reports that say that there was a group of 3 or 4, that they were wearing white clothes, white hats. I think it's dangerous to kind of draw connections where we just don't have information at this stage to do it. And I think it's particularly worrying that some analysts, you know, are arguing that these have direct links to overseas organizations, that they demonstrate a growing sophistication and coordination. I just don't think we have the evidence thus far to make those sorts of claims.
Are these kinds of high-profile attacks in public places unusual in China?
No, I mean, China has a long history of sort of public violence. What I think is slightly different here is the connection with Xinjiang, the connection with Uyghurs, and attacks occurring outside the Xinjiang autonomous region. You've had lots of Han-on-Han violence in China proper, knife attacks in schools, knife attacks in public places. And as we know, you've had a lot of violence as well in the Xinjiang autonomous region that's really driven by ethnic tensions between mainly the Han majority and the Uyghur minority. So we've seen a number of attacks inside Xinjiang. What is new here is that you're seeing a sort of spilling of these ethnic-motivated attacks outside of the Xinjiang autonomous region, as well as a sort of change in target. In the past, most attacks, ethnic attacks perpetrated by Uyghurs have been largely perpetrated on symbols of the party state, whether it be police stations, police officers. And now we see, at least certainly in Kunming and Tiananmen and Urumqi, an attempt to target innocent civilians. So that's new. But, I mean, drawing another link with, you know, organizations outside of China, linking it to the global jihad, I just haven't seen evidence yet to convince me that's the case.
Last month, Chinese President Xi Jinping visited the Xinjiang Autonomous Region, where he encouraged security forces to devise effective ways to deal with terrorists. Xi was quoted as telling security force personnel they are the fists and daggers in the fight against terrorism, and called the Kashgar region the front line in anti-terrorism and maintaining social stability. The Chinese leader also visited an ethnic Uyghur village and emphasized the need for a better quality of life, including economic development. He emphasized China as one family of many ethnic groups.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook, VOA Asia.
The World Health Organization is warning air pollution is getting worse in many cities around the world, putting the health of millions of people at risk. In the largest study ever done on the state of urban air pollution, data from a survey of 1,600 cities across 91 countries reveal people living in these cities are breathing in dirty air. The World Health Organization says this puts millions at risk of serious long-term health problems. WHO Public Health and Environment Director Maria Nera calls this a major public health issue.
The situation we have in front of us tells us that globally, unfortunately, the situation on air pollution is deteriorating, with an exception on high-income countries where the situation is, as expected, improving. But these represent only 12% of the population living in cities.
The World Health Organization estimates 3.7 million people under age 60 died prematurely from outdoor air pollution in 2012. It says nearly 90% of these deaths occurred in low- and middle-income countries, with the greatest number in the Western Pacific and Southeast Asian regions. Health officials say bad air increases the risk of death from heart disease and stroke, as well as respiratory illnesses and cancers. In a world that often insists on neat entertainment genres, some singer-songwriters will not be boxed in. Meet Somi, a singer-songwriter born in the Midwestern U.S. to African parents. She is both a Harlem jazz singer and an Afro-pop diva and something more. VOA's Adam Phillips has her story from New York.
When Somi plays at hip New York venues like Joe's Pub, the mood can be distinctly African and homegrown American. That's because Somi has roots in both worlds. Somi lives in Harlem, home to one of America's largest African diaspora communities and a rich heritage of jazz and African-American arts. Somi was born in the U.S., spent part of her childhood in Zambia, did a post-college stint in East Africa, and later toured the continent with her band. But relatively early in her singing career, she felt somewhat misunderstood on both sides of the Atlantic.
Felt like people wanted me to be either an African artist or a jazz artist or a this artist or a that artist. And I was like, but I'm actually all of those things.
Her life changed in 2011 when she was offered a teaching fellowship in Lagos, Nigeria, a city packed with 20 million people.
I got there and the energy was difficult, was challenging, was inspiring, was hard but beautiful. Was tragic but magic.
She kept a journal of her impressions and musical ideas inspired by Nigeria's huge cultural and financial capital. Her song, Ginger Me Slowly, featured on her upcoming CD, The Lagos Music Salon, dates from that time. In Nigerian slang, to ginger someone means to spice them up, to make them happy. Somi's adventure coincided with Occupy Nigeria, a highly visible grassroots movement fueled by anger over the government's cutting of fuel subsidies. A friend's housekeeper told her she could no longer afford to visit her family in the countryside on her $2-a-day wage, which Somi says is the Nigerian average.
You know, she was a widow, she had kids to feed, she had to, you know, figure out how she was going to get to and from the mainland to the island and continue this job, and she was devastated.
The encounter inspired Somi to write a song called $2 Day. Some other new songs also explore difficult, even painful themes like genocide, sex work, female circumcision, and body image.
But also talk about the beauty and also talk about the magic, you know, and also talk about what might inspire both myself and the people around me.
Somi says her time in Lagos feels like a dream to her now. It's a feeling she and her audience might never have known had she not searched out the heart of her Africa and then returned to her Harlem home, deepened and renewed. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On May 8, 1541, Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto became the first European to see the Mississippi River. De Soto headed an expedition that landed on the west coast of Florida in search of gold and silver. On this date in 1846, U.S. troops under the command of American General Zachary Taylor defeated a superior Mexican force in the Battle of Palo Alto, north of the Rio Grande River. Mexico had sought to reassert its authority over the territory that is now a part of the United States. In 1884, former President Harry S. Truman was born. Truman became president when Franklin D. Roosevelt died in 1945. It was Truman who ordered the atomic bombings of two Japanese cities at the end of World War II, witnessed the signing of the UN Charter, and directed U.S. forces to defend South Korea from invading North Korean forces in 1950. In 1886, Georgia pharmacist John Pemberton sold his first Coca-Cola soft drink to the public. At first, the drink was advertised as a valuable brain tonic that could cure headaches, relieve exhaustion, and calm nerves. Today, Coca-Cola is one of the most popular soft drinks in the world. In 1902, the Mount Pelee volcano on the Caribbean island of Martinique began its deadliest eruption, burying the city of Saint-Pierre and killing virtually all of its 28,000 residents. In 1945, May 8th was widely celebrated as VE Day, or Victory in Europe Day. The celebration came a day earlier for British Commonwealth countries and a day later in Russia. It marked the surrender of German forces during World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During his 2013 State of the Union address, President Barack Obama called for the eradication of extreme poverty worldwide by the year 2030. One of the keys to achieving this goal is to prevent and control diseases that disproportionately burden the poor. This includes vector-borne illnesses, those transmitted by mosquitoes, flies, ticks, and bugs, such as neglected tropical diseases. Over a billion people suffer from one or more neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs. Sometimes also called diseases of the forgotten people, these illnesses affect mostly people living in rural areas and urban slums of low-income countries. They are most common wherever access to clean water and sanitation is lacking, and where children suffer from malnutrition. NTDs are devastating both to those who suffer from them and to their communities. Many of these diseases can impair intellectual development in children, reduce school enrollment, and hinder economic productivity of entire communities by limiting the ability of infected individuals to work. These usually treatable and preventable diseases include schistosomiasis, elephantiasis, trachoma, Chagas disease, river blindness, leprosy, Kala Azar, dengue, black fever, and other forms of leishmaniasis. And the three most common infections, the soil-transmitted parasites, hookworm, roundworm, and whipworm. Together, they cause as much damage as HIV, malaria, or tuberculosis. The United States has been a part of the global effort to control these diseases since 2006. Then, 2 years ago, working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. government joined Uniting to Combat Neglected Tropical Diseases, a partnership that also includes the governments of the United Kingdom and United Arab Emirates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the World Bank, 13 pharmaceutical companies, and other global health organizations dedicated to accelerating progress toward eliminating or controlling 10 NDTs by the end of the decade. As of 2012, the USAID NTD program has supported the delivery of 820 million treatments globally. Controlling and perhaps eventually eliminating these diseases cannot be achieved by one group or one country acting alone. The problem is too widespread, too complex, and must be attacked on many levels. It will require much effort, funding, and political will. Only by working together can we hope to overcome these ancient causes of human misery and improve the lives of over a billion people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.